Let's get started, please. I'd like to thank everyone for being here. I was running late myself. Representative Butler is running late, but he asked that we go ahead and get started. Our first speaker today, well, let me give you a little bit of background information. Since late October, I've been trying to get some experts to talk to us on the link between housing and education, and it was time after time after time, we just couldn't work it out. But then, first week of December, all of a sudden I had three experts all at the same time say yes. So we were able to work out with two of them, and I am so happy because I was so frustrated early on trying to find someone. But the first person who's going to speak with us today is Professor Ingrid Ellen from the Furman Center for Real Estate and Urban Policy at NYU. And what we're going to talk about today, we've talked about impediments. And what we're going to try and do in this meeting and the next meeting is put a face on it and say, okay, why do we care about these impediments? What's the so what question? To give it a tangibleness. So if we'll start with Professor Ellen, and hopefully the technology will work out well, and she can see us down in the lower right corner. That's how she sees us, and she can also take questions. And let us know, Professor, if you'd like to take questions while you're doing presentation or if you'd like to wait till the end.
Okay. Can you hear me now? Yeah? Okay. Okay, great. Well, thank you for inviting me to speak. I'm very sorry that I can't be there in person. And I can't see all of you. So I would love to take questions as I go along, but you'll have to sort of gesture loudly and move into the side of the camera. I think I'm going to stop at one or two points and just affirmatively ask whether you have questions. The first question I have for you actually is whether you all have the handout.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So we did this work. I'm going to talk about some work that we did that was supported by the Poverty and Research Race Action Council and also the MacArthur Foundation. And we did this work nationally, but we also pulled out for today, I've sort of pulled out a separate analysis for Connecticut and for the three largest metropolitan areas in Connecticut for your benefit. And I just want to start by saying sort of the stating the obvious, which is that housing units provide a lot more than shelter. They provide access to neighborhood amenities, to a set of neighborhood services, and most critically, a local public school. And yet housing and education policymakers rarely coordinate their efforts, and some critics charge that assisted households and children living in assisted housing are constrained to go to very low-performing schools. But in fact, there really had been very little or no empirical work on that question until we started this. And so what our purpose was really fairly simple, which is to describe the elementary schools that are nearest to each household with children receiving different types of federal housing assistance in Connecticut, well, in nationally, but then also in Connecticut, and show how those schools compare to the schools that other children have access to. And if you just, you know, turn over to page two of this handout, the second page of the handout, the summary of the results, just very briefly, is that assisted households in Connecticut live near to lower performing schools than other households. So they live near to lower performing schools than other households as a whole in the state of Connecticut. They live near to lower performing schools than renters as a whole in Connecticut. And they actually live near to lower performing schools than poor households that are unassisted in the state of Connecticut. So poor households that don't live in subsidized housing actually have access to better schools than poor households living in assisted housing. The project-based Section 8 results, I'll show you sort of those tenants living in project-based Section 8 developments, probably have access to the worst schools, the lowest quality schools, The patterns seem to be least extreme for the tax credit program. And generally, we see sort of similar patterns in the three largest MSAs, Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport, although there are some differences, and Bridgeport probably looks the most extreme. So on page three of the handout, I want to just describe a little bit our methods, and then after that, I just want to stop and make sure that it's clear what we actually did before I go on to just telling you, showing you some of the numbers. We basically used confidential data from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to basically obtain addresses for all federally assisted households in the country, but also in particular in the state of Connecticut. That includes voucher holders, tenants living in project-based Section 8 developments, tenants, residents living in public housing, and residents living in tax credit units. We tried our best in the case of public housing voucher holders and tenants living in project-based Section 8 developments. We were able to restrict only to households with children, because obviously we're most interested in school access for families that have children. In the case of tax credit developments, we didn't initially have access to data on the actual tenants, but what we did is we restricted to two-bedroom units or apartments that are two bedrooms or more. And we found in other analysis, this basically about 90% of those large units are occupied by children. School-aged children. So we think that's a pretty good proxy. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. And then what we were able to do is we were able to, through GIS methods, identify the elementary school within the district that is nearest to each of those households with children. So in other words, for every single subsidized household, and frankly every household with children in the state of Connecticut, we were able to identify the nearest elementary school that was still in their school district. Okay, and we're using that as the proxy for the school to which that child is zoned. Okay, I know that is not perfect either, but we have done some other tests of that, and we find, you know, we actually did this in New York City, where we actually have the actual attendance zones, and we found even in a dense city like New York City, where you think that this method would be the worst, because there's so many schools that are close to children, we found that about 75% of children in New York City attend the local elementary school that is closest to them. Does that make sense? Okay. And then what we did is basically we're able to categorize each of those schools according to their percentage of students that are eligible for free and reduced price lunch, according to the racial composition of the students, and according to the performance of their students on standardized tests. And we focus most on this last metric. What we basically do is we have the proficiency rates in math and reading for every single elementary school in the state of Connecticut. And we average those, and then we rank all schools in the state of Connecticut according to that their proficiency rate, okay, from the highest proficiency rate to the lowest proficiency rate, and we create essentially a percentile. So we can tell you for every school in the state of Connecticut, oh, that school is at the 10th percentile of performance in the state of Connecticut, right? That school is at the 85th percentile of performance on standardized tests in the state of Connecticut, okay? Does that make sense so far? Okay. And then what we did, mostly what we're doing is, so, you know, for instance, you could have a particular voucher holder might live near to, their nearest school might be at the 10th percentile of performance in terms of proficiency rates and have 80% of their students eligible for free and reduced price lunch, where another voucher holder might be near a school that's at the 40th percentile of proficiency rates and maybe have a 60% of its students are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. Most of what we're doing is going to be reporting on the median student within each group. So we'll tell you about sort of the nearest school to the median voucher holder, essentially, or the median characteristics of the schools nearest to voucher holders in the state of Connecticut or in particular metropolitan areas. Okay. Is that any questions on that so far, what our methods were? Okay, good. Okay, so then let me move on to page four, the next page of the handout. And this is sort of just the overview table. The first column shows describes the schools for Connecticut, and then as a comparison, I provided you the same numbers for the United States as a whole as sort of a benchmark. Okay? So what that tells you, that first number, that 15 number, okay, in the first row in the proficiency percentile rank for Connecticut, tells you that the median bachelor holder in the state of Connecticut lives near to its nearest school is a school that falls at the 15th percentile. Okay, that means that in terms of proficiency ranks, that means that 85% of the schools in the state of Connecticut perform better on standardized tests than the school that is closest to the median bachelor holder. Okay? We have a similar number for public housing, the median public housing resident. Again, and when I'm saying it's median with kids, so it's the median bachelor holder family with children. The median public housing family with children in Connecticut is near to a school at the 15th percentile of performance. Project-based Section 8 tenants with children are near to even slightly lower performing schools. Interestingly, the tax credit units, these large tax credit units, appear to be nearer to somewhat higher performing schools. If you look at the first line, tells you the performance of the median, the school nearest to the median two-bedroom tax credit or two-bedroom or larger tax credit unit was at the 32nd percentile of performance. So, considerably higher, still not. So below the median in the bottom half, but then what I did is I pulled out just the tax credit units to give you a portrait of kind of what's going on today. I pulled out just the tax credit units that have been placed into service in the last 5 years, and you can see that number actually falls somewhat. So the tax credit units that have been placed in service recently appear to be placed. And being placed on average in neighborhoods with lower performing schools than the universe of tax credit developments in the state of Connecticut. Okay. And just the bottom three rows just kind of give you a benchmark. I mean, not surprisingly, if you look at all households in the state of Connecticut, right, the median household with children in the state of Connecticut lives near a school that's basically the median school, right? Sort of by definition. Yep.
Could you back up one more time, and I want to make sure I heard this correctly. You're saying that new affordable housing or new vouchers are being placed in schools that are at the 15th percentile or lower?
No. So what if you are you talking about the tax credit numbers?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, what the tax credit number tells you is that it tells you overall, if you look at the universe of all tax credit developments that are currently built, right, that are occupied in the state of Connecticut, that median tenant, right, that median family with children in tax credit developments lives near to a school at the 32nd. That's sort of just at the top of the bottom third of the performance distribution. What the next line tells you is that the tax credit developments that have been built more recently are actually near to lower performing schools. Okay, they're near schools at the 27th percentile. So it's not, a hugely dramatic difference, but it is sort of, I guess one could say it's going in the wrong direction than one would hope. And then if you look at renters overall in the state of Connecticut are near low performing schools relative to the state. They're in schools that are about at the 26th percentile of performance, and poor households live near the schools that are about the 19th percentile of performance. Okay? The median poor household. So you can see that just comparing these numbers, I think in some sense the most telling comparison to me is that, if you look at the subsidized tenants in general, these subsidized families living in subsidized housing, they're living near to schools that are lower performing than even poor households as a whole. So in other words, poor households that are living in subsidized housing appear to have access to lower performing schools than poor households that aren't living in subsidized housing in Connecticut. Okay. And you basically see that same pattern in the, if you look at the second column in the United States as a whole. Connecticut is not a complete outlier on this. I will say sort of across the board, the performance of the schools near to both, you know, to renters, to poor renters, to subsidized tenants is lower in Connecticut than it is in the country as a whole in general. And that's relative performance. Okay, so this is all benchmarked against other schools within your state. Okay? So does that, any questions on this table so far? No? Okay. So then, looking at the next table, table five, page five, what we did here is just compare the poverty rate or the, well, it's really the percent of students in a school that are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. And you can see that, you know, for the subsidized tenants, but except for the tax credit to develop the tenants, they're living near to schools that where the poverty rate is sort of 75 or 80% for the students in the school, about 75 or 80% of their classmates in the schools that, that are closest to them are eligible for free and reduced price lunch, right? And that compares to only 21% for all households, sort of the median household in the with children in the state of Connecticut. So, you know, much, much higher levels of poverty and disadvantage in the schools that are close to subsidized housing tenants. And again, the tax credit developments, the tenants living in tax credit developments do appear to be living near to somewhat less disadvantaged schools. But again, if you look at the units that have been the last 5 years, those units have higher poverty neighborhoods relative to the full universe of tax credit developments. Okay, and that, again, the sort of similar patterns, a little bit more extreme than the country as a whole in the state of Connecticut. Okay, and then what we wanted to do on page six is to just show some of the extremes. I mean, so far all I've been talking about is the median voucher holder, the median public housing tenant, the, you know, the median tax credit renter, the median poor household. And maybe what we really care about and should be most concerned about is the extremes, and in particular the share of children who are the lowest performing schools. And so what this first column on page six shows you is the share of children in these different categories who are living near to schools that are in the bottom tenth of the performance of the state as a whole, okay? So what that shows you is over a third of voucher holders, over a third of public housing residents, and over a third of project-based Section 8 tenants of children living in those types of housing live near to a school where that falls in the bottom tenth of performance of schools, elementary schools in the state of Connecticut as a whole. So, and for, again, for tax credit developments, that looks a little bit better. It's about a quarter, only a quarter, but that still is a large number when you look at, you know, overall, only about 9% of children in the state of Connecticut live near to schools that are at this bottom tenth of performance in the distribution. Okay, and the second column shows you, we also thought, well, it would be interesting to see, okay, how many of these, you know, kids go to sort of the Lake Wobegon schools, the schools where that are in the top half of the distribution in the state, and you can see that only 7% of voucher holders, 13% of public housing kids, and 6% of kids living in project-based Section 8 developments are in schools that are fall in the top half of the distribution in terms of test score performance in the state of Connecticut. About just over a third, actually, of children living in tax credit developments live near to those schools in the top half. I think I didn't look to have time to look specifically. I think that's due to sort of the tax credit developments driven by the tax credit developments that are located in the suburbs, quite surely. But I wasn't able to unpack that. And then we just looked at the schools that with extreme poverty as well. We looked at the share of kids within these categories that are living near schools that were over 80% of the children are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. And there you can see where in the state as a whole, only 13% of kids live near to schools that have these high levels of disadvantage. When you look at subsidized tenants, kids living in subsidized housing, it's more like 30, 40, and even 50% of public housing residents are living near to their closest school has a free and reduced price lunch rate of over 80%. Okay, so these are highly disadvantaged schools. What we then did was we tried to pull out, and I want to qualify this by saying that, you know, the samples are necessarily small, the number of developments is necessarily small in some of these metropolitan areas, but we are describing all of them. So we looked at Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven. Okay, so on page 7, you see the picture for Bridgeport. This is the Bridgeport metropolitan area, so it's Bridgeport plus its surrounding suburbs. And you can see that these comparisons are really stark. And if you look at the tax credit developments, the children living in tax credit developments in Bridgeport are near to very low performing schools. So schools that are falling only at the 7th percentile of performance within the Bridgeport metropolitan area. And you can see that, you know, for across all, if you look at the percent of kids eligible for free and reduced price lunch, essentially they're going to, you know, their closest schools are 100% of the kids are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. So these are schools of concentrated poverty that are largely minority and are performing, you know, either at the 15th or, down to the 7th percentile of performance in terms of state tests, standardized tests. If you look at Hartford, there you see that fairly grim, and that the voucher holders, public housing kids, kids living in project-based Section 8 developments live closest to schools that are at roughly the 10th percentile. So these are the bottom 10% of schools in terms of performance that they have access to. The tax credit, you know, was a little bit better, but there, even so, it's only, you know, about 20%. The schools nearest to kids living in tax credit developments fall only about at the 20th percentile. Okay, and if you look at, and I should say in Hartford, though, let me be careful. Let me stop here for a second and just say, I know that this proxy that we're using, remember, I don't know what schools these children are necessarily attending. So if they are being bused to a suburban school, okay, I'm not capturing that here. So this kind of tells you what schools children in Hartford would attend if there were no busing and if there were no magnet schools, if they were attending their local, you know, their zone school. Okay, does that make sense? So I think these patterns are probably much more, they look more extreme here perhaps than they are in reality.
We did a similar analysis, not nearly as in-depth as you've done here for the analysis to impediments report, and we did it statewide looking at school performance in their corresponding census tract. So we took the social economics from the census tract and said most of the kids in this census tract will go to this school.
Yep.
And our findings are very similar to yours. The methodology is a little different. But one issue with Hartford is there's a lot of movement. Hartford is basically an open choice district.
Yeah,
you can
exactly.
go anywhere. So when you talk about Hartford, there's a lot of caveats. But statewide,
yeah.
What you're seeing and what we're seeing are the same.
Yeah. Well, the way I almost pulled Hartford out and wasn't going to show it, but then I just thought, well, it does give you a picture of, I think, of what the school disparities would be if there were no busing and if every child actually attended their local school. So I think that's really how to interpret the Hartford results.
Okay, and Professor, and thank you for being here today and sharing your findings. This is State Rep. Larry Butler. I just had a quick question about when you talk about the nearest schools nearest to the households with children.
Yeah.
How did you kind of measure that in terms of what's the measurement and the criteria in the area that you're actually measuring with that?
Right. So that's a good question. Basically, what we have the address, we actually have the residential address of every subsidized, of every household with children, actually, but every, certainly, well, that sounds true. We have every address of the subsidized households with children, okay? And so what we do is we know all the school district boundaries. And so what we do is we use geographic information system methods to basically identify the nearest elementary school that is still in that school district, that child school district. So we don't just use the nearest school, because sometimes that nearest school, they might be living, their family might live on the border of a district, and so might be in the neighboring district. But, and we found that doing some other tests, we found this is a pretty good proxy for the school that those children actually attend.
Professor, hi. My name is Alex Knopp. I work on the chef case with Phil Tegler, so he said to say hello to you. I just want to say about 40 or 41% of children in Hartford attend a chef-related, yeah, either magnet school or open choice school. And at some point, it might be interesting if we could get the cooperation of the State Department of Education. I know Trinity College has done some research also, is to take your chart about Hartford and compare it to the actual attendance that is caused by the chef open choice programs, both in the magnet schools and in the suburban open choice districts, to see the kind of variant it produces. Because obviously, as you said at the beginning of your presentation, that housing and education policy are often rarely coordinated, and one can imagine the outcome of a good state policy, both to work for desegregation in housing patterns and in education choices. And I think the chef case would be an interesting way to compare the default analysis that your study has done based on kind of geographical relations to the actual choices made under the chef court decision, which I say is almost half the children in Hartford.
Yeah. So I'm having a little bit of difficulty hearing you, so I'm going to repeat what I think you asked, which is whether, and I may be totally wrong, maybe. City, and there are a few other schools, large urban school districts around the country where we can do this, is we actually have the, in cooperation with the school district, we're able to actually identify the schools that the children actually attend. Not the schools that are closest to them, not the schools that they're even zoned for, but the schools they actually attend. And that we're doing that work in New York City right now. We'd be delighted to do that work in the Hartford metropolitan area, but we would need to get cooperation of the school district to actually identify to get essentially a student file with addresses that we could then match to our subsidized, the addresses of the subsidized households.
Yes.
Did that answer what
you
were saying?
No, I was saying I think that would be an interesting study to compare that chart to the chart you have here, which is a default.
I think it would be very interesting,
chart.
And in some sense, there would be a really good comparison, because it would tell you kind of what the world would look like without CHEF, I think, versus what the world actually looks like once you have this remedy in place.
Yes. Thank you.
This is Erin Boggs, and I just wanted to reiterate the point that was already made about the value of the data as it is. It sort of shows us what the world would be like without CHEF, and we're assuming that we don't want to have that kind of solution. We want to have a solution where kids are going to great schools, and we're not sort of building additional schools and doing everything that we have to do to comply with CHEF. So we want our subsidized housing to be built in a way that avoids that kind of the kind of situation we're in right now.
That's right. Yeah. I'm not sure I heard what you said, Aaron, but I mean, I think one thing that would be interesting is just sort of what the take-up is among subsidized renters. I don't, you know. Anyway, I'd be happy to talk to you all further about doing that extension, which, you know, it would be interesting. We're able in a lot of cities now increasingly to actually get the school attendance zones. So we can be a little bit more precise in knowing what schools children have access to. But again, that's not going to be that relevant in a metropolitan area in a region like Hartford where you have a really extensive choice program. And so even those attendance zones are not that meaningful. So just let me shift to the next page. It's actually the last table is New Haven. And there, you know, you can see again, these are, you know, not, I think they're whatever sobering numbers, let me just say, is that again, the children living in federally subsidized housing, particularly this project-based Section 8, I have a feeling that that's probably kind of one development. Are living near the schools that are really the very lowest performing in the state. Kind of at the bottom tenth of the percentile, and same thing if you look at sort of, you know, the percent of children that are eligible for free and reduced price lunch in those schools. So again, it's sort of, you know, I think that these patterns. I would just reiterate that, you know, I think what our results show is that subsidized families with children living in subsidized housing seem to be living near to schools that are, you know, lower performing than the typical households, that are lower performing than the schools near to the renters as a whole, and living near to schools that are lower performing than the schools near even to other poor households that are not receiving federal housing subsidies. So I think that this, you know, does raise the question of what we can do to, you know, we're trying now to sort of dig in a little bit further and try to understand these patterns. We're particularly focused on, a little more focused on voucher holders, which is, you know, this is the Housing Choice Voucher Program, and one would have perhaps, I would have anyway, I did expect that Housing Choice Voucher holders would have had access to higher performing schools, but I think it just shows there are a number of constraints in the voucher program that make it very difficult for families to move to higher, you know, higher opportunity neighborhoods and to neighborhoods with higher performing schools.
I have a question from Erin Kemple.
Hi, my name is Erin Kemple. And you just answered one of my questions, which was, did you have any recommendations as a result of this of ways to reverse this pattern? If you have other things that you are looking into or researching, I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, it's sort of what we are doing, focusing a little bit more on is right now is the voucher program. You know, in a sense, as I'm sure you all know, that, you know, the new housing that is being subsidized housing that is being developed around the country is through the low-income housing tax credit. So I think that those numbers are important, and I think really, on the one hand, those look better than other forms of subsidized housing. On the other hand, that's a very low bar. We have sort of a sorry history of citing our subsidized housing developments in this country in the highest poverty neighborhoods with the lowest performing schools. So I'm not sure that's exactly the benchmark that we want to shoot for. And I think that it is somewhat troubling and was surprising to me that across the board, when I pulled out the more recently built, the newer tax credit developments, those developments are located near lower performing schools than the universe, than the ones that were built earlier. And so I think, you know, I did not have a chance to look at the qualified action plan for the state of Connecticut, but I think looking hard at that and thinking about what are the incentives that are being, you know, provided to developers to build housing in different types of communities, and is there a way to maybe provide a bit of a stronger incentive to build low-income housing, tax credit housing in higher opportunity neighborhoods with access to higher performing schools. I would say that I would put, you know, up there as a priority. And I would also say I think understanding, you know, learning more about what's happening with the Housing Choice Voucher program in the state of Connecticut as well. That's the other kind of live program that is still, you know, actively, you know, although less active with sequestration, but and trying to, you know, whether that is through trying to understand what, I mean, you know, I've been looking at a few housing authorities across the country, and in many cases, voucher holders are actually, they're really steered to high poverty, low opportunity neighborhoods with low performing schools, and they're steered through basically the housing authority when households get vouchers, families get vouchers, they're given a list of landlords in many cases who take vouchers. All right, this is even in places, right, where everybody, you know, where there's laws that make it illegal not to take a voucher. And on the one hand, this, you know, it's well-intentioned, and I think it is, you know, the housing authorities are trying to make things easier for the voucher holders. But if you map out, we've sort of looked at the location of many of the housing units that are, you know, most of the housing units that are on those lists that are provided to voucher holders, and they are in very high poverty neighborhoods in with access to the, you know, with the lowest performing schools. So I think thinking, you know, and at the other extreme, thinking about, so I think thinking about sort of the kinds of information that voucher holders are given about their neighborhood choices and about their school choices in particular, there is increasingly the kind of data that we've used here that is much more readily accessible than it was. So it wouldn't be that difficult to give every voucher holder in the state of Connecticut a list of all of the, you know, the schools, the elementary schools in the in that metropolitan area, in that region, and what their characteristics are, what their test scores are, and thinking about, you know, some kind of at least some kind of light touch counseling program that helps those families identify housing opportunities in a broader array of neighborhoods than they're currently looking in, I think.
Thank you. That was extremely helpful. My other question was with regards to the public housing.
Yeah.
Were you just looking at federal public housing, or did you also look at state public housing?
This is just federal.
And it's so federal vouchers also.
I'd be happy to look at the state. I didn't have the data.
That I just wanted a clarification. Thank you.
Professor, I have a question, and I don't know that you'll have an answer, but it's my understanding that federal law states that the voucher program is not supposed to create this situation where we have high segregation. How did we get here? You know, if the law says specifically don't do this, and then we look and it's doing it, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah. Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm going to defer to Aaron to, you know, and I think you're a lawyer too, if I'm not mistaken. So I will say that I think some of it is this sort of, you know, well-intentioned but ultimately misplaced policy of trying to help voucher holders by providing a list of landlords. I think there's, you know, that who are, you know, who commonly accept voucher holders. I think it's a little bit of a, again, it's a leftover from an era where, you know, there was that, where every landlord had to did not have to take voucher holders, and it was difficult to get landlords to accept voucher holders, and I think those lists are ultimately very unproductive. I mean, look, some of the concentration is due to the location of units that rent below the fair market rent. You know, there is a limit to how much to the rent that the rent level that a voucher can subsidize. That actually turns out to be a relatively small share of the concentration of voucher holders. It seems much more that there are kind of pockets of neighborhoods where, partially because landlords don't face the same kind of demand on the from unsubsidized renters, that they're very happy to take voucher holders. And so I think that, we need to, housing authorities need to do more outreach to landlords. I think that's a big piece of it. And then provide more information to tenants as well about, again, to make sure, look, it is a choice, right? So I don't think that any of us would want to dictate where households, which neighborhoods households should live in, but we want to make sure that we're empowering households with the information and families with the information that they need to make good choices that are going to be a good match for their families and frankly, I think most importantly, a good match for their children. And the school is a critical part of that. And increasingly, like I said, that information now, had we been talking 5 years ago even, I would have said that information is not available. But now, increasingly, it's pretty easy to get good information about school characteristics and performance on a state basis or region.
Okay, we have a few more questions.
Hello, Professor. I'm Cheryl Sharp. I'm the designee for Senator Bartolomeo. I have a question about the research for the Hartford area. Because it is an open choice area, there are magnet schools in Hartford. If a voucher holder was living near a magnet school, did your research pick that up? And if there were low-performing magnet schools, is that taken into consideration in the data that we were provided, or is it not?
Yeah, I think that we do not have the magnet schools in here, but I need to get back to you on that. Now that you're asking that question, I'm realizing I need to check that 100%. Okay. It is only what we've done is elementary schools also. So any magnet high schools would clearly not be in here. We were doing elementary schools because, and frankly, we're using, I didn't say this, it's all fourth grade test scores. And the reason was that we just thought generally, kids travel further to their middle school, and it's really the elementary school around the country where the location of your home really determines your school access much more directly than at the middle school and high school level.
Representative Rojas?
Thank you. My name's Jason Rojas. I'm a state representative. I missed the beginning part of your presentation, but I wondered to what degree does your research take into consideration kind of the Connecticut context, in that local land use decision making is very localized, as well as the providing of education to children, very local level, very small geographic areas. To what degree does your research take that into consideration?
This research doesn't, it's just sort of describing the outcome. There's no question that I think, local land use control plays a part of this. It plays a part in driving, economic segregation and, around the country, not just in the state of Connecticut, but I think that is a big part of it. And that's a big part of where the tax credit developments are going to be located. That's a big part of even where voucher holders can locate, because if you've got, if there's municipalities that will not allow multifamily housing or rental housing, then, or allow very little of it, then there are going to be very few housing units open to voucher holders in that jurisdiction.
Yeah, that was kind of the thinking in listening to you speak, and I don't think there's any lack of desire on the part of the developers perhaps to develop in high opportunities areas. I think they're just prohibited from doing it, or there are a lot of incentives for them to avoid going perhaps to certain municipalities that they know have a record of not allowing that. So thank you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that is a critical piece of the puzzle, and I should have said that earlier. So thank you.
And Boggs?
I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the findings in the analysis of impediments that really dovetail nicely with what has been said. First is that we did do an analysis of the lists that landlords are giving out in Connecticut, and found that for some programs, and I'm just trying to remember off the top of my head, I think it was something around 75% of the addresses given out were in areas that were disproportionately minority to compared to the state as a whole. And I think for the program run by the state itself that used to be with DSS and has recently been transferred to the Department of Housing, I think it was like 90% of the recommendations were in areas that were disproportionately minority. The other thing we found that was a really big difference is a difference between the percentage of minority voucher holders versus white voucher holders living in areas that are disproportionately minority and disproportionately low income compared to the state as a whole. I think there was a 20% difference between the number of white voucher holders versus minority voucher holders living in high poverty areas. So part of the message here is there might be a barrier that has to do with race. The other is that it's possible for a voucher holder to live outside of a high poverty area, and white voucher holders are managing to do that.
Yeah, that's right. Aaron, I'm glad you mentioned that. I was just remembering that you had done that analysis.
Do you have any other questions? Professor, do you have anything else you'd like to...
I think the only other thing that I would say is just that, we tried to pull out the elderly, the tax credit developments that are targeted to the elderly, but separately, and I didn't show that here in the tables because I was focusing on schools, but if you just look at the poverty rates of the neighborhoods where the tax credit developments that serve the elderly are located as compared to the neighborhoods where the tax credit developments that serve children are located, there's a pretty dramatic difference. And the tax credit developments that serve children on average in the state of Connecticut, I think, are located in neighborhoods where the poverty rate is about three times as high as the poverty rate of the neighborhoods that of the developments that serve the elderly. So,
yes.
Again, I think that's something that's pretty important for policy.
Yeah, we did pull that information out, and we did find that developments targeted to the elderly are predominantly in low-poverty areas, and developments targeted at families are predominantly in high-poverty areas. Representative Rojas?
Is there any harm or good that could come from limiting where tax credits can be used based on some measure of segregation or poverty or any of those type of indicators?
So you're saying that you could, the state qualified allocation plans are designed to set priorities and basically provide incentives to developers to locate, build certain types of housing, to serve certain types of populations, and to locate in certain types of neighborhoods. So there are states around the country that now provide kind of bonus points to additional basis points to developers that locate their tax credit developments in higher opportunity areas. And I think that's, something that, I can send you some links. I think PRAC has done work on this. But there are states around the country now that are really experimenting, and Texas, New Jersey, that have rewritten their qualified allocation plans to try to provide the truth is the federal law itself, kind of provides incentives for developers to locate their developments in the highest poverty neighborhoods. And so they're really designed to counter those incentives and balance, create a more balanced portfolio of neighborhoods.
But even if there's that desire and responsibility to do that, how do you compete with kind of my earlier comment about decisions being made at the local level that don't even allow it, which makes it kind of a moot point?
So I'm not sure I heard that, how do you get developers to actually do it?
No, if we can incent developers, or there are these bonuses that can be provided to developers to develop housing in high opportunity areas, what does that matter if local land use decision making isn't going to allow it anyway, or make it more difficult? And perhaps that's not a question for you to answer, but.
Right. Okay. So you're talking about the land use side. So right. So there are two hurdles, right? The first is the developers, right, is where they want to build. And then the second is where local governments will let them build. And there are other states that have, certainly that have fair share programs. But more lightly than that, I think you could certainly instruct, you could provide information to localities to show them where they are on kind of the share of low-income housing that their jurisdiction is providing, and maybe that would, I think, you know, the new research on kind of behavioral economics suggests that, you know, that kind of public disclosure and information can actually nudge jurisdictions to be a little bit more open. It's one thing to sort of be privately hiding the fact that there's no low-income housing in your area. There's certainly other ways also that the state government, through different kinds of funding, can incentivize, you know, or disincentivize exclusionary zoning.
Actually, I'd like to touch on that, too, because we do have housing incentive zones that we're starting to give grants to municipalities to build affordable housing incentive zones. And the incentive really is if we could encourage and develop that in the high-performing school districts, that those towns won't have to worry about developers building where they don't want them to build. Sometimes they could use our affordable housing statute, the notorious 8-30G, and developers may build in a town in an area where they don't want this development necessarily, where a developer could circumvent local zoning. But if they build the incentive zones, now the municipality kind of controls where the development can go, and that's more of the carrot. And if we could do more of that in high performing school districts, then I think we could start to counter this whole scenario.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I appreciate, I mean, all of the kind of tools that we currently have in place now. My concern is that year 2150 we'll still be in the same place, or maybe we'll make some incremental steps in terms of dealing with this issue, but I think given the voluntary nature of all of our policy right now, I just don't see how we ever get there, at least in my lifetime.
Okay. And Aaron, I'm going to call on you next, but really I could tell you that there's a strong initiative now, and our commissioner of housing is here, but I could tell you that there's a significant amount of grants given to towns that don't traditionally do affordable housing. So we're really expanding on this model, and as long as we give the funding to Home Connecticut to actually help them in this area, I think that we're going to see this take off now. I think it's going to start growing as long as we show commitment to this initiative.
Yeah. No, I don't make any of my comments in criticism of what's in place. I'm just afraid that the carrot eventually gets really, really old and becomes a stick of some kind. But
I agree with you, and that's why I want to wholeheartedly support our Department of Housing and Home Connecticut, because this is one area that we can counter a lot of these statistics that we see that, you know, hasn't happened. But we're starting to put carrots together, and we're trying to put policy together to address it. And I think if we all get behind it and support it, that we could make some inroads. And once we see some of the success stories, hopefully it'll feed on itself and grow. Representative Case, I believe you had your hand up a while ago, and then we'll go to Aaron.
Thank you, Professor. Representative Case here. Hey, quick question. When we talk about impediments, and with your study you've done here on education, in a lot of the suburb towns you look at, the HUD housing and elderly housing, HUD, or are put in different places within the communities. For example, we have a very large, in one of the towns I represent, a very large, probably there's 400 units of HUD housing, and they're about 4 miles from the schools. And we have six elderly facilities that also take in HUD and take in disabilities that are in the downtown district. So to me, it doesn't really make sense, because there's a really impediment on transportation with the kids getting to after school activities and doing different stuff. I realize they're bused to school, which is fine, but we're giving an opportunity for the elderly to be right downtown so they can walk to where they need to go. So there's just a disparity, and once again, as I've said in the beginning, it comes down to transportation.
So I'm not sure I fully heard that, but I think what you said is that the subsidized housing or proposed subsidized housing is very far from the closest school, so the children would have to take a long trip?
Yes, that's exactly correct. And it's there's probably two or three of them in one of the towns. And it causes for an issue for the children to do after school stuff, yeah, because a lot of those homes, the parents are working two or three jobs, so they, you know, getting to different activities is difficulty.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know the specifics of that. I will say that sort of, you know, around the country, there are a lot of families and high-income families, middle-income families, low-income families that are willing to have their kids travel a lot farther than 4 miles to go to a good school. And so...
Yeah, no, and I completely understand that, but with a family that doesn't have a vehicle or doesn't have transportation.
I think my kids go 4 miles away, but again, granted, they take the subway, so
we don't have that opportunity, you know.
Why don't you build a subway in the state of Connecticut? That solves your problem.
We'll take the busway.
Very touchy issue. Aaron?
I just wanted to respond to what Representative Rojas was mentioned earlier about the low-income housing tax credit program and whether we could change it so it was only being developed in certain areas. And I think there's a lot we can do on that. But we have to you have to be very nuanced with that program, and because there are instances where low-income housing tax credit developments are actually very good for poverty-concentrated areas, especially if, and I would say maybe only if they're come along with other economic development, bring in more mixed-income housing than was there previously. And, you know, there are a lot of sort of requirements for that. But in thinking about this, we just might want to consider having almost two sets of criteria for low-income housing tax credit developments, those that are going into higher opportunity areas and those that are going into lower opportunity areas.
Yeah.
Representative Case, do you want
to? Yeah, just one last comment. And when I spoke last time when the other Aaron, gave a presentation, I think we really need to look hard at the town's POCDs when we look at these facilities that we're approving to be built for HUD housing, because from what I understand, only 50% of the POCDs throughout the state of Connecticut are complete and up to date, and that should really be something in there that we concentrate on so that the poverty level housing or the HUD housing is put in areas that can help out the population that it serves.
Okay, well, Professor, thank you very much. Professor Logan's been sitting here quietly and patiently. He drove up from Rhode Island, which is not much more than 4 miles away, actually. He says he took the subway.
All right. Well, I'm sorry that I couldn't be there in person, and good luck with your important work.
Well, thank you. And this technology, it's worked out really well. Peter, is this the first time it's been used?
Good.
Awesome. It's the first time it's been used in a building. A great success. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Do we want to take a 5-minute break, or are you afraid of losing people?
No.
We'll keep going then. Okay.
People need to take a break.
Next, we're going to have Professor Logan from Brown University. He's a professor of sociology, also very well versed in segregation. I believe he's also done some work in Boston. I'm not sure if he'll be talking about that at all. But if you have questions, please hold them. Professor?
Microphone's on? Yeah. Oh, this is very nice. Oh, you guys have good chairs. Okay. Everybody can hear me. I can see the PowerPoint. Let's see if I can control it. How does this touch? Oh, there's the touchpad. Okay. So, I'm impressed with the conversation so far. Actually, it's clear to me that that you people are thinking a lot about this issue about impediments to fair housing. We've got some blowback here. Is there a... Okay. Okay. I think it's a very good idea to go beyond just the question of housing itself and ask about the environment that the housing is located in. And schools is probably the single most not only important to people's lives, but also easily measurable characteristic to work with. And so it's a very good choice. And especially because I've been involved in a number of fair housing cases around the country, places like the infamous Westchester County, you all know about that case. You know, I was involved in providing evidence on that case, and I couldn't believe it when I read their analysis of impediments, and it didn't mention race. You know, like, what? Like, what is going on? So you are so far ahead of what many jurisdictions are even willing to think about. I'm impressed by that. And yet, as we talk about what are the national trends and then what is it that actually shows up in Connecticut, I think we have to be aware that even those people who are talking seriously about impediments aren't necessarily doing much about them. No, and I'll start with HUD. Actually, I think HUD has been a major problem. The fair housing groups I've been associated with over the decades, often when they brought a lawsuit against a locality, HUD was a co-defendant because, oh, why HUD? HUD is supposed to be the shining example of, you know, we've got these laws and HUD's going to enforce them. And always HUD was the co-defendant because HUD was failing to enforce the regulations that were supposed to be supportive of a desegregative effect of federal housing expenditures, and the fact was that HUD pretty much was just ignoring, you know, whatever the locality reported, whatever they put in their annual report, whatever they put in their analysis of impediments to fair housing. Even in Westchester, HUD said, yeah, okay. You know, you fill out the form. That's all that's required. And so there's been talk about possibly that's changing. And now we're several years into the Obama administration. We can't blame previous administrations anymore. And I have hopes that, in fact, HUD is going to not only promulgate but enforce some new standards, some new levels of review, a little bit more rigorous evaluation. But I'm not sure that I have a great deal of confidence. I think it's more likely at the state level that it will turn out that there are some states where policymakers not only are aware of problems, but decide that this is a problem worth tackling. It's difficult. I know it's difficult because, in fact, the degree of segregation that we see, the degree to which subsidized housing programs reinforce segregation and tend to put families in the most impacted areas, is actually carrying out the implicit mandate from the society. This is what Americans want to be done. If we don't really think about it, I mean, you know, I'm so much more comfortable if those people are somewhere else. And if that's the outcome, that's the outcome we like. And working against that is very difficult. Some of you, I'm not sure, are you all elected officials? So those of you who have to run for election, you have to be aware that there's a lot of people who actually don't really care very much about the problems that you're identifying around the table here. and that you've got to sometimes tread very cautiously on it. And so even in progressive states, I think that there are limits to the degree to which public policy is going to make a difference. Well, as an academic, just like Ingrid, my job is just to keep reminding people of what are the outcomes that we're seeing, and to some degree, just how bad they are, because it's a surprise to a lot of people. Over the years, I've talked to a lot of newspaper reporters and other media, for example, about the fact that we continue to have a high level of segregation in American public schools and a high level of segregation in American neighborhoods. And they say, well, geez, you know, you mean really? Because for the average American, what they experience in their daily life is, oh, the society has become so much more diverse. Talking about New York City, where, you know, Ingrid's famous discussion about the subways, I know a famous urban historian who told me that, oh, well, in New York, we don't have a problem of segregation because you just go on the subway and you see all kinds of people. Yes, yes, but where are they going? You know, where do they get off? Where did they get on? Well, actually, it's quite segregated. And then he also said, yeah, well, okay, but I may live in this part of Manhattan, but three blocks away, there's a very different kind of people living there. And I saw, and I asked, and how often do you go three blocks in that direction? No. People live in their little neighborhoods, and they're very homogeneous enclaves, and yet it's possible as an American to feel like, no, it's a diverse society. We can celebrate diversity. It's all around us. And in fact, even in the neighborhoods that people live and the schools where their children go to school, they are more diverse than they used to be. Because there's so many more Hispanics and so many more Asians, and there continue to be a lot of African Americans in the society. And so the average white American used to live in a neighborhood that was 90% white, non-Hispanic white, and now it's 75%. And so in people's experience, say, oh, man, it's getting so diverse. All kinds of people in my neighborhood. But the average African-American is living in a neighborhood that's majority, well, close to majority black and has a very small percentage of whites. You know? So they're living in a very, they're also living in quite diverse places, but it's a very different diversity than the diversity that whites experience. But I think this is an important factor, that the average white American lives in a world that looks diverse and their neighborhood and schools are getting more diverse than they used to be. Like I went to a suburban high school in Kansas City, and in my class, all the way through elementary school and junior high school, I was in that area, there was never a single African American in my school. Never a single one. Say what? And what was the diversity? It was, well, some of the kids went to the Jewish country club, and some of the kids went to the not Jewish country club, and that's what I knew about diversity. So, oh, compared to that, it's a different world. But the result of this impression that people have is that so many Americans believe that we've gotten past the problem. Oh, we passed the fair housing bills. We had this big civil rights movement, and we don't see that movement anymore, so it must all be solved. And that's a big hurdle. Big hurdle. So why do we still have the problems that we have? In part, it's because people aren't aware of it. And I'm just saying, as an academic, I see that a lot of my job is to point out that, no, actually, we're not in the promised land yet, you know, by a long shot. I often say, for example, at the rate that black-white segregation is decreasing in America, at the rate that it's happening decade by decade by decade, when my grandson, who's like, the older one is 11 years old, when he's my age, and I've been dead for quite some time, then blacks will only be as segregated as Hispanics in America. Say, oh, man, so that's progress, right? So, and this is what really motivates me, is that I came of age in the 60s and early 70s, and I thought things were changing. Things were going to change. I thought change was in the air. And so it's so disappointing to realize that, you know, I'm going to be gone. And it's not going to be all that much different. It's going to be different, but not all that much different than when I was young and hopeful. So, okay, so that's a prelude. I only said all of that stuff because listening to Ingrid's data and your questions and answers and so on, it got my blood boiling a little bit, and I feel I have to tell you how I see things a little bit. Now I'm going to just give you some data, give you some information, and let you decide what conclusions to draw from it. And I'm going to talk about neighborhoods, and I'm going to talk about schools, and I'm going to give you some national picture. And in the end, it's going to turn out that Connecticut's not all that different from the national picture, but I think it's useful to know what the national picture is and the trends, and then drill down more locally at the end. So let me start with the observation that the average white, black, and Hispanic person in metro areas in America lives in a neighborhood where a majority of neighbors, 50% or more, are the same race or ethnicity as they are. And that's represented in this chart. Many of you have copies of this now. If it's in color, it'll be easier to read, but even in black and white, I think it's readable. So you notice, for example, that the average white lives in a neighborhood that's, as I said, 75% white, and has some blacks, Hispanics, and Asians too, and that's the diversity that they experience. The average black person lives in a census tract that is more than half black. And there's whites. There's about 30-40% whites and a bunch of Hispanics and Asians. And Hispanics, too, on average, live in neighborhoods where they are the majority group. And, you know, like one way to talk about that is that we have a society where people grow up in neighborhoods where what they learn to do is to be part of the majority. And whites know how to be part of the majority, and blacks grow up knowing how to be the majority, and Hispanics grow up knowing how to be the majority in their neighborhood. And we're not very good at teaching people how to deal with being a minority. I do a lot of research in China, and actually I find that it's quite challenging to be the only white person in, you know, like, very often at a conference, there's like 250 scholars, and I'm the only one who doesn't speak Chinese. You know, like, and being a minority is a really interesting experience, but it's one that the majority of Americans haven't had. Yeah. So that's just a fact. Another fact is that segregation is changing. And black-white segregation is the one that's been the most extreme over the years. And I have shown here a chart that the blue line is something we call an index of dissimilarity. And it measures how differently blacks and whites live across neighborhoods. And if it were a total apartheid America, that neighborhoods were either all white or all black, the value would be 100. And if people are all mixed up randomly, it'd be about zero. And so it reached a high point of almost 80 in the 60s and 70s. Very, very high degree of segregation. By comparison, in South Africa, Johannesburg, at the height of apartheid, the value of this measure was 90. But the average American city was at 80. Without apartheid, some of my colleagues wrote a book called American Apartheid about the issue of black-white segregation, and some people said, what do you mean, apartheid? But actually, in terms of its reality, it was very close to apartheid at that point, and we've come a long way since that time. down to an average of 59. So there's been real change, and I celebrate that progress. And yet, as I said, it's gotten to be fairly slow. 4, 5, 3 points per decade. You say, well, how many more decades? How many more decades? And then the other side of this is the red line gives you a measure of exposure of blacks to whites. The average black person lives in a neighborhood that's what in terms of white population? And in 1940, the average black person lived in a neighborhood that was 40% white. Now, a lot of blacks lived in all black neighborhoods, but some blacks lived in very, very mixed neighborhoods. The average was 40% white. And by 1980, it had dropped to 31% white, which less whites in their neighborhood by 1980. And it's changed since then, but it's hardly changed. Now it's up to 35% white. The decline of black-white segregation has not resulted in black people living in neighborhoods with many more white people. What's changed, in fact, is they're living in neighborhoods with a lot more Hispanics and Asians. That's the primary change that we've seen since 1980. So declining black-white segregation doesn't mean greater exposure of whites to blacks or blacks to whites. So that's just another fact of the situation about neighborhoods. And then I can't make a presentation like this without mentioning that some of the most important metropolitan areas in America, metropolitan areas that have historically had the most significant, substantial black communities, that in many of them, what I showed in this previous chart, is down to 59, the index of dissimilarity, down to 59 on average in America. But if you look at New York, Chicago, Detroit, Newark, Milwaukee, Gary, Indiana, they're all 75 or above even now. We have these huge pockets of continuing very high levels of segregation experienced by blacks, and is counterbalanced by some newer parts of the country where things are changing more quickly or never were as segregated. But I'm sorry to say that Connecticut is in the middle of this ghetto belt. And I didn't include the Connecticut metropolitan regions here because they're much smaller. But if I were to list them, you'd see that they're in the 60s and low 70s. Right? They're all above the national average. There's a historical thing here going on, that when African Americans moved in large numbers to these metropolitan areas, it was an area of a really rigidly enforced segregation. And we do not have mechanisms to break that up. Instead, it turns out we have mechanisms to reproduce segregation even when blacks move to new areas. I found, for example, that when there is a suburbanization movement for African Americans, that in many cases what it amounts to is moving to a new set of communities, and in fact, on average, they turn out to be communities with better schools and lower crime, but they become majority-minority suburbs. So, you know, kind of a black suburban ghettoization. So we reproduce this historical segregation more than we break it up. Another very important thing to understand about segregation is that it's all about race. The average American thinks that it's not about race anymore, it's about income. You can live where you can afford to live. If African Americans and Hispanics live in different neighborhoods, it's because that's all they can afford. And there's some truth to that, because across all metropolitan areas in the country, Hispanics and African Americans have family incomes that are only about 60% as high as non-Hispanic whites or Asians. So, like, the income gap is a very significant income gap. It ought to have an effect on where people live, quality of the neighborhoods that they can afford. And yet, when we look at the data closely, we find out that income makes a little bit of a difference, but not so much, actually. That really affluent African Americans live, and really affluent Hispanics live in neighborhoods that are kind of like where poor whites live, in terms of racial composition, not even. So I'm going to show you two tables like this, and there's a lot of numbers in these tables. Some of you are used to looking at lots of numbers, and for some of you, you look at this and say, look at all those numbers, and your eyes are going to glaze over. But I've circled some that are worth really paying attention to. And so first of all, let me explain what this shows. This is exposure to your own group, which we call isolation. The average person lives in a neighborhood that has what percent of what other group in the neighborhood, or the same group. So the average non-Hispanic white in the 2005-2009 American Community Survey data that I had to use for this lived in a neighborhood that was about 75% white. Whoops. And whites whose incomes were under $40,000, they're approximately in the lower third, lived in neighborhoods that were 74% white, and whites making over $75,000, so they're really in the upper, some of you make more than $75,000, but I'll bet some of you don't, lived in neighborhoods that were 75% white. Really, income didn't make any difference for whites in terms of the racial composition of their neighborhood. So then let's look down to the next circles for non-Hispanic blacks. And it shows that for, let's see if I can get this cursor to come back. Yes, for poor non-Hispanic black families, the average lived in a neighborhood that was 43% black. And for really affluent, like those making more than $75,000, there it is, 36%. Well, there's a difference. Rich black people live in neighborhoods that have a lower proportion of black population, and in fact a higher proportion of whites and others than poor blacks. But it's only 6% difference. It's not so different. Like, it's entirely different from where whites live. And among blacks by income, the differences are really very small. And if you read down the chart, you'll see that there's a little bit more difference among Hispanics, but still, they're all living on average, in places that are pretty Hispanic. And exposure to whites for poor blacks versus rich blacks, not very different. For poor Hispanics versus rich Hispanics, a little bit more of a difference, but it's just not so different. The big difference is Hispanics, regardless of income, live in Hispanic neighborhoods. And blacks live in black neighborhoods, and whites live in white neighborhoods, regardless of income. I'm also going to show you a table about poverty, the poverty rate of the neighborhood where people live. Again, I'm just giving you, this is just the data. You know, like, there's no spin here. This is just the fact, right? So you decide what to make of these facts. So what is the percent poor among the neighbors of different kinds of people? So among whites, on average, 10% poor. Poor whites, it's 13% almost, and among rich whites, 9%, a little bit of a difference. But mostly, white people don't live in poor neighborhoods. And this is what ought to really blow your minds. The average black family with an income of over $75,000 lives in a neighborhood that the poverty rate is 14%, There it is, 14%. But the average white family making less than $40,000 lives in a neighborhood. It's only 12.9%. It's less poor. Why? It just shows that being a rich black person doesn't like make you equal in terms of the outcomes of the community that you live in. No, it doesn't. No, there's a very strong racial component. The same is true among Hispanics. The average rich Hispanic person lives in a neighborhood that's a little poorer than the average poor white. So, and really this should blow your minds, because we all believe that income ought to be making more of a difference. But it turns out that race and ethnicity is really quite a powerful boundary. Okay, so now I'll turn to schools. And I'll show you some very similar kinds of patterns. I don't have exactly the same kind of data. For this first part, I used the census. And a neighborhood was defined by census tracts, which are areas of about 4,500, 5,000 people. And every 10 years, I've got data about who lives in census tracts by income, by race, by some other characteristics. And so that's what I showed you for all metropolitan census tracts in the country. I showed you the averages. Now, I'm using a data set put together by the National Center for Education Statistics, which tells us about the characteristics of every individual school in America. And what I've done is, these are the data for all public elementary schools. And just as Ingrid did, I'm using the fourth graders to represent what I'm calling an elementary school. In fact, it's very difficult to define elementary school. Some of them are grades K to 5. In some places it's K to 3, and then there's 4 to 6. In some places it's K to 12. It's, you know. So I'm counting as an elementary school any school that has fourth graders in it. And I'm averaging across these schools by how many fourth graders there are. And so that's what these data are about. It's not the nearest school, like Ingrid was using. No, it's the school that they attend. Okay, so this first chart looks a lot like the neighborhoods, except a little bit more extreme. The average white is in a school, public elementary school, that's close to 80% white, and the average black, it's something like 60% black, and the average Hispanic is more than half Hispanic, and even Asians, and Asians are only 5 or 6% of the country, are in schools that are over 20% Asian. So, again, this is what segregation means in terms of the composition of the schools that people are in. And so here's a table that provides some more information about those schools. It gives their racial composition and the percent of kids on free or reduced price lunch and the average test scores and the average math scores of the kids attended by white children, fourth graders, black fourth graders, Hispanic and Asian fourth graders. And the test scores, I did the same thing that Ingrid did. I created a ranking of all schools within the same state. And the best school was at the 99th percentile, and the worst school was at the first percentile. And, you know, so then I could make comparisons that went across states. They all use different tests, but what this means is, what's the percentile in relation to other schools in the same state? Okay, so if we look at the data for test scores, there's my cursor, okay. Whites and Asians, Ingrid made a cute reference to Lake Wobegon, which I have also used in presentations before, like, you know, the place where everybody's above average. Well, So whites and Asians are in the enviable position that on average, they're in schools that are above average. So, you know, good for them. And in fact, this is very consequential, because when we talk about the problems of schools and questions of school policy and how much should we invest in schools, and what are we paying teachers and how are we recruiting and training them and how are we managing and so on, what this means is the average white or Asian parent ought to be pretty satisfied. You know, they're in Lake Wobegon. But the average black or Hispanic parent ought to be very unhappy, because their kids on average are in schools that are at the 27th, 28th, 33rd, 35th percentile. And so this is where the motivation and the stimulus for change in school policy would be coming from. And I think it probably is where it's coming from. And unfortunately, these are the groups that have the least influence in our system. But so these differences in test scores are very consequential. First, because they tell us something about the opportunities available to kids of different race and ethnicity, but also because they have implications for what will be the political support for changing the system. And I think it's important to think very hard about that side of the story. The test scores, I think, directly reflect the poverty rates in the schools. Actually, I think these, when I first saw numbers like this, I was pretty shocked that the average white kid, elementary kid, is in a school that 42% of the classmates are eligible for the free lunch program. Jeez, I said, how much poverty do we have among children in America? You know, like 42% is very high. And for Asians, it's 52%, but for Hispanics and blacks, it's 68-75%. It's like most of the kids on average in their school. Right? And so on the one hand, the absolute levels are something to think about. And no wonder schools have difficulty. Actually, I should admit, 1, 2, 3 of my 4 children are teachers. And they talk about, you know, what teaching is like. And they all talk about that it's hard. And I think one of the reasons it's hard is because their school environments, there is so much concentrated poverty in school environments, except for some exclusive affluent communities sort of separated out by themselves. But on average in America, it's pretty tough. But for black and Hispanics, it's tougher. And I also sort of just repeat the data about racial composition that I showed you before. Okay, so these are some more relevant facts. Another relevant fact is that the disparities in test scores between blacks and whites, or between blacks and Hispanics, the disparities between them in a metropolitan area very directly reflect the degree to which these groups are segregated in that metropolitan area. So this is a graph, and on the vertical axis up and down, it shows how big a disparity there is between white and black reading scores. Like 1.0 means they're equal. 3.0 means that the white score is 3 times as high, like it's at the 60th percentile compared to the 20th percentile. So those are the extremes. And on the horizontal axis is how segregated are kids in the schools across schools in that metropolitan region. And it's very highly, you know, very highly associated. I guess I could have picked out New Haven. It's in there somewhere, you know. But why pick on New Haven now? But I do want to get to Connecticut. This is where I do get to Connecticut. And I'm going to present you, there's some things that I can present for the national averages. And then I can show you separately the 3 metros that Ingrid used. And I've also got New London in there too. New London's a little different, as you'll see. But so how's Connecticut doing on some of these things in terms of neighborhoods and in terms of schools? And what are the differences across regions in Connecticut? This brings it home to you. Is Connecticut just like the nation? Do you suppose? Is this your image of the world? Is Connecticut worse? Better? Okay. So in terms of segregation, well, I've got one chart in which I've got the neighborhood data and the school data. And the first column is the national average for metropolitan areas across the country. And then I've got Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, Norwich, New London. And this is just, what is the racial and ethnic diversity that we are working with here? Like, you know, like what's the raw material for segregation and inequality? And as I say at the top, there's a high level of diversity in both the total population and the school population. Norwich, New London is a little different. It's a lot wider. Schools are a lot wider. But the other three metropolitan areas have a degree of diversity that's rather comparable to the nation as a whole. So Connecticut's not an outlier in that respect. And then I've got measures of the degree to which people are segregated. Segregation from whites in the neighborhoods and segregation from whites in the schools. And, okay, so notice that I've italicized, kind of highlighted the Asian data, the rows for Asians. Asians are a lot less segregated. First of all, they're less segregated than blacks and Hispanics. But in Connecticut, there's a very big difference between the national average and the Connecticut averages. Asians in Connecticut really are a whole lot less residentially and school segregated than they are in the nation as a whole. And, of course, they're much less segregated than they are than are blacks and Hispanics. So there's something that you may know better than I do about what kind of Asians are living in the state of Connecticut. You know, are they like a, really a whole lot of professionals, or, you know, I really don't know. So I sort of bracket those out.
Professor, in Connecticut, Asians are predominantly professionals, and their social economics follow those of non-Hispanic whites. Very different, let's say, if you were compared to Asians in California, two different groups.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that's sort of what this suggests. Nationally, actually, Asians have higher incomes than whites. And nationally, Asians live in better neighborhoods than whites. That's surprising, huh? But anyway, that's more true in Connecticut. But the data on segregation in neighborhoods, at the national level, the average black-white segregation on my measure is a 59. In Bridgeport, it's 66. Hartford, 62. New Haven, 62. Well, they're a bit higher. And there's not that strong a difference across those three metro areas. Norwich, New London is much lower. And for Hispanics, also the levels of segregation in these three Connecticut metropolitan areas for Hispanics are higher than the national metropolitan average. So Connecticut's a little bit of an outlier. You'd expect to see the same thing in schools. If it's true in the neighborhoods, it's probably true in the schools, and you look at the data, and yes, it is. It's true. Not very big differences between metropolitan areas. Now, I'd like to comment on the Hartford thing. There was a lot of discussion about Hartford, the Chef case. Hartford's all different. Ingrid measured things by what was your nearest school, but not what school you went to. I'm measuring it by what school people are going to in the metropolitan area. That's what I've got. And I have to say that, well, you know, black-white neighborhood segregation in Hartford is a little lower than Bridgeport, but the same as New Haven. Black-white segregation in schools in Hartford is about the same as New Haven and a little lower than Bridgeport. You know, like, I don't see the chef effect here. The chef effect would be if the schools were less segregated, even if the neighborhoods were equally segregated compared to other metropolitan areas. No, the schools are equally segregated for blacks and they're equally segregated for Hispanics. I really thought I was going to see something different in Hartford because I've read about this case and there's a lot of publicity and I don't know. I haven't looked at exactly where are the kids going. How many kids? But I can show you this is the net outcome. It's not that different from what Ingrid showed you.
Representative Rojas has a question.
Just a quick clarifying. On the Hartford one, you're talking about the Hartford MSA, so West Hartford, Hartford, East Hartford?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. The same metropolitan area as defined by the census as Ingrid used. Okay. So that's levels of segregation. Yes. Blacks and Hispanics in Norwich, less segregated. Other Connecticut metros are above the national average. And now I'm adding, and no apparent Hartford effect. And now I've got exposure to poverty in the neighborhoods that people live in and in the schools that their kids go to. And poverty in the neighborhoods is based on income and is a very different measure than we can use for schools. For schools, it's free lunch eligibility. A lot of kids that wouldn't meet the national poverty income standard, but they're eligible. They get to be eligible for free or reduced price lunches. So you can't compare the percentages between the neighborhoods and the schools, but we can compare within neighborhoods. We can compare whites, blacks, Hispanics, and Asians, and we can compare the Connecticut metropolitan areas to the nation. And what do we see? Well, I bracketed the white and Asian data, and they're all lower. And the black and Hispanic exposure to poverty in neighborhoods, higher. And on average, across the nation, blacks live in neighborhoods that are 19% below poverty. In the Connecticut metropolitan areas, it's all a little bit less. I think that might partly be because Connecticut is a higher income state. But anyway, that's true. Not very big differences between metropolitan areas in Connecticut. And I see among Hispanics, it's more like, looks more clearly the same as the national picture. Actually, I have to say, none of these differences look very big to me between the national averages and Bridgeport or Hartford or New Haven. I would not make a big deal about them. But I would make a big deal about the difference between white and Asian exposure to poverty in their neighborhood and black and Hispanic experience. It's a very big difference. And the same is true about schools. Well, okay. Nationally, the average white elementary kid is in a school that's 43% eligible for free lunches. In all the Connecticut metropolitan areas, it's a lot lower. Okay. That reflects there's not that much white poverty, I think, and there's not that much poverty in Connecticut on average. But if we look at the black and Hispanic data, the poverty levels in their schools is a whole lot higher. It's not twice as high, but it's a whole lot higher. Boy, if you were sending your kid to school, you'd notice the difference between a 40% poor school and an 80% poor school, and you'd think about it. And the the Connecticut figures don't look that different from the national averages. Connecticut is just like the nation. In a sense, I'm saying, oh, the good news is that Connecticut's not really worse. No? Yeah. But the bad news is Connecticut's not doing better. And sort of those are, that's one of my overall conclusions, that we've got big problems in America, high levels of neighborhood segregation, and those translate into high levels of school segregation, even though we've had policies that seek to desegregate school systems for a long time. But because we only desegregate within districts, all of the boundaries between districts, they just really show up very strongly. And in Hartford, where there have been efforts to blur those boundaries between districts, I don't see the impact that I would have liked to see. Blacks and Hispanics living separately means living unequally. That segregated blacks and Hispanics, regardless of income, end up in poorer neighborhoods and poorer schools. And Connecticut is like the national patterns, except there's something different about Asians in Connecticut that has to be understood. And that blacks and Hispanics are a little more segregated, and it translates into higher poverty environments than we would expect on a national comparison in the schools. So we got trouble right here in River City.
Professor, thank you very much. I want to expand on one part of this. You say that Connecticut's no better, no worse. But there's another part of the state's demographics that makes the segregation, educational achievement issue important to the state, and that's that we're rapidly aging and that the workforce, in the future workforce, is disproportionately minority, Hispanic and black. In 2025, one of every five Connecticut residents will be over the retirement age. And increasingly, the population that's going to work to provide the services for those retirees is minority. So that, and it talks to Representative Rojas' issues, how long do we wait? You know, how long is it going to take? Can Connecticut wait 100 years and 150 years to get over this just from an economic perspective? You know, isn't it in the state's best interest that even though, you know, we may be the same as the rest of the country, but that the changing workforce in this state is much different than what you see in, let's say, in Texas. That makes it more of a problem, an issue for us here. I don't know if you have a comment or not.
Oh, I do, actually. That's a very important conclusion that you've drawn, and I agree with it 100% that Connecticut will be stuck with the labor force that we train today 20 years from now. And that labor force is going to be predominantly Hispanic. More Hispanic, it will also be black and Asian, but it will be a lot less white than the current one. And that's problematic to the degree that blacks and Hispanics are getting less education. The thing which actually I'd like to add to what you've said is that actually, the same trend is happening in Texas and California and New York, other parts of the country that are faster-growing places, because faster-growing places are also faster-growing because of immigration. And Texas, the state of Texas in the last decade had a significant population growth. That population growth came almost entirely from an increase in the Hispanic population under the age of 20. That's where it was. That's the bulge, you know. That's where the growth is coming. And California has some different dynamics, but more both Hispanic and Asian. So what you're describing it as an issue, a real practical economic labor market issue for Connecticut, I think shows up in most areas of the country. And to the extent that one would say we have to figure that policy is going to follow self-interest, this is a big part of the self-interest argument, that segregation and particularly unequal educational opportunity is going to come back and bite us.
Representative Rojas? Just a follow-up on when you made your comments about you perhaps expected more to come out of desegregation efforts in Hartford in the context of CHEF. Now, are you looking, were you making that statement understanding that the effort was simply to desegregate Hartford schools and not the MSA? So that you're not taking into account.
Well, actually, I may have misunderstood, but I thought that there were Hartford students attending school in suburban schools and that there were suburban kids attending school in Hartford schools. And so that's where I really expected to find an impact. But I suppose that the scale is not, you know, where it would need to be to really impact these numbers.
I think part of the limitation, and if others have information, I mean, with open choice, I think that the majority of students participating in open choice, Hartford going to the suburbs, aren't necessarily going to East Hartford. East Hartford, I don't even believe, is allowed to take open choice students. So I didn't know if that skewed the data to some extent when you're looking at the Hartford MSA or East Hartford, West Hartford, Hartford MSA.
Yeah. Well, you know better than I do, like, what kids are going where. And that's what's having the effect.
Yeah. Is it, go ahead, Aaron.
I was just wondering the extent to which your research has gotten into solutions, into places that have addressed all these deep issues of segregation. Have there been things that you've seen that have worked?
Did you say pollution?
Segregation.
Oh, solution. Oh, solutions.
Yes, solutions.
I'm sorry.
Let's just change the subject entirely.
Well, there are environmental problems too, but we and crime issues too that we could talk about. But oh yes, solutions. Yes, solutions are very hard to come by. I have to say I have vacillated on this question a bit. On the one hand, a whole lot of what we see is illegal discrimination in the housing market. That's a big piece of what we see. There's other things going on. People are choosing where to live. People are where they are comfortable. There's all kinds of things like that. There are market forces. But there's illegal discrimination in the housing market, and that's a piece of the problem that we see. And I think that it's wrong that we don't prosecute it, that we don't investigate it and prosecute it the way we investigate any other kind of crime. You know, like, oh, we just got $1.5 billion from J.P. Morgan Chase, right? Because we went after them. It didn't fall in our laps. We went after them. And just what would have to be done with housing discrimination. But the way that we deal with housing discrimination is that if somebody thinks they're discriminated against, they've got to bring a case. And they've got to get the data. They've got to provide the proof. And judges tend to think, like the average American thinks, that no, landlords wouldn't do that. It's not in their interest because they need the tenants. And so a lot of good cases get tossed out. But a lot of cases just can't be made. And a lot of people don't know that they're being discriminated against. And so there is, I would say, there is no enforcement of the laws on housing discrimination. There could be. Federal prosecutors in every district in America could make this a priority, just like organized crime or terrorism. Oh, yeah, terrorism or something. You know, we could decide that discrimination in housing is important. And it's hard to say how much of a difference that would make. I kind of think it would make a small difference, but it would make a very significant symbolic difference for us to say as a society that, in fact, this deeply offends our deepest values. And to say it, not just it's on paper somewhere in a law, but that actually actively we deal with it. So I'm in favor of that. I'm in favor of some improvements in how HUD policy, HUD funding is carried out and requirements for municipalities and housing authorities to be more aggressive in expanding the range of neighborhoods in which a housing voucher can be used. And, you know, and I think when they don't do that, that they should, you know, the stick should be used. Money should be withheld. I think so. But I have to say that I don't honestly believe that's going to change the world. You know, these things. There's a lot entrenched, built in, that no matter how much we do trying to change
where people live, I don't think there's that much leverage to change it that much, even though I think we have to do it. We are ethically, morally required to do it. I think we should. So therefore, I think that the remedy, the major practical remedy, has to come from compensation. Oh, you live in a bad neighborhood, but let's provide a decent quality of life in the neighborhood. And that means the policing, the schools, the physical environment. Let's try to make these places less unequal than they are. Okay, you have to live in a segregated neighborhood, but why should you have to pay such a cost to live there that the infant mortality rate is 3 times as high? Why should it be? That's my point of view. And that the school has, twice as big a dropout rate. And that the, why does that have to be? I don't think it's built in. I think it is based on how we fund public services and how we make decisions about how land use decisions and service area decisions and policing decisions are made. There are areas that we protect and there are areas we don't protect. And we make those decisions. We could change the decisions that we make. And so I think that's where the biggest leverage is, which unfortunately means lock into place the bad neighborhoods, but make them less bad. I'm sorry to say that.
Representative Brohaus.
But isn't that what we've been doing for the last 50 years?
No.
What place-based solutions?
Is that we haven't been doing anything to make bad neighborhoods less bad. We have done nothing. I don't know. Am I jumping too fast to a conclusion? Let me try to think of something we've done that deconcentrates poverty or that improves schools in the worst neighborhoods. No, can't think of one.
Yeah, perhaps not with schools, but with development dollars, pseudo economic development plans to improve neighborhoods. I mean, at least in the context of Hartford, all we really care about is downtown and not the neighborhoods. But
Okay. So in fact, we've had this rhetoric about empowerment zones, about improvement. I don't know. What's the current one at HUD called? There's one.
Promise.
There's a new one. It's something about enabling. I don't remember what words are used. But what it comes down to is we provide subsidies for certain kinds of activities in certain kinds of areas. And what are the and how are those subsidies used? Well, this is why we sue HUD. Is because it's used for real estate developments. It's used for convention centers. It's used for, it's used for all kinds of things which are like perfectly wonderful, except that they don't have any impact on the unemployment rate in that neighborhood, or the quality of services in that neighborhood, or they don't. It's just window dressing. What I'm saying is, we need a space program kind of effort for bad neighborhoods in America. We have to be willing to spend $50 billion and for half of it to be wasted, just as NASA wasted half of their money, but they got us to the moon, right? I think that's what we have to do. But, are we prepared? Is it what we value?
Professor,
the average white and black, the average white or Asian parent is in Lake Wobegon. Remember that.
Yeah. That's a hypothetical. Okay, let's say we spend $50 billion on the lowest income, poorest areas of the state, or we spend $25 billion on improving access to housing in the suburbs.
Yeah.
What's the outcome?
I think that if you could actually do it, I think that moving people, that integrating neighborhoods by race and class, is the long-range effective solution. Integrating neighborhoods, where neighborhood means the area within which people collectively share
a kind of living environment and quality of life, and schools and policing and health and everything. Integrating, that's the thing that has the long-range potential, and I think it's also less expensive.
Yes.
However, I think it's something that Americans don't want to do.
Yeah, well, that's the point I'm trying to make, is that economically there's a added cost to, you know, segregation in our urban centers. We don't look at it that way, in that if we spent our money eliminating that segregation, that low-income segregation, and the social isolation that comes with it, that we would have better outcomes.
Absolutely. It's the smart choice, but you know, Americans don't always make the smart choice. We make the gut choice, the one that feels good inside. And for many of us, what feels good inside is what we've experienced and what we're comfortable with.
Yes. Representative Case, I see you, but I want to jump in here first because I agree with you in a certain sense. Why don't we address the areas that need the most attention is the logical way to pursue this. But I can tell you the political will, whether it's on the federal level, especially on the federal level, that's not going to happen. It's just not there, because in the minds of some of those folks, in the purse strings they have, they just view that as throwing good money after bad. Why should they spend their money there when there's other things like convention centers and everything else that you talked about that, okay, we could see the value in that. But and that's one of the things that I think we really need to wrestle with, because until we do address our impoverished neighborhoods and municipalities, then we're going to still see these issues with the schools. We're going to still see the issues with the violence. So if we want to proportionally change outcomes in our education and violence in these neighborhoods, we need to do that. But that's going to be an ongoing struggle. But I wanted to get to one of the charts you had about the segregation, and this wasn't a national chart, about the poor and the affluent. And you gave national numbers, but I was wondering how that plays out in Connecticut, where where there was, in the poor white category, there's like almost 13%. And for the same the time, yeah.
You're talking about this chart?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So the poor whites are 12.9% in 2005 to 2009, and the affluent blacks are 13.9%. I mean, that's amazing.
See, it's just hard to believe. So how about? Do you think it's true in New Haven or Bridgeport or?
I was wondering, did you do this in terms of Connecticut?
I did it for everywhere. In fact, do we have an internet connection here? Can I pull up a browser? Are we? Because I have this on a web page where you can look up any metro area in the country and see exactly this chart.
Yes, and I'd love to see that.
So I'll just tell you where it is. It's let's see. Where do I? I got it.
Well, I'll click on new tab and then put put the browser about tabs. Type in the name.
I need to type in.
Put your cursor in the browser about tabs, where that is.
Here? Oh, put it here.
Yes.
Okay.
And then you could type in what you want.
High tech. You know, I have research assistants and students who know how to do these things. And I still have an Atari computer with... No, I don't really, but I did. Okay, so this is the URL. It's the U.S. 2010 webpage, s4.brown.edu/US2010. I just learned that the Library of Congress has decided to archive this site because they think that there's a lot of good stuff in there, and I'll just show you one of them under data. There's also maps if you wanted to see all of this stuff mapped out. but I've got a site here called Separate and Unequal View Metropolitan Areas. Oops. And I'm going to look for poverty about the neighborhood by income, and I'll choose the most recent data. And which metro area do you want me to start with? I'm sorry. What? Is Waterbury a metro area? No. I'm sorry. I have this for counties. I could do this for the county that Waterbury is in, but let's start with Hartford, since I'm in this tab, and you can see submit. Okay, so you can see what the kind of table it looks like. Okay, so this is that table for Hartford, West Hartford, East Hartford in 2005-2009. So the average poor white lived in a neighborhood that was 8.5% poor. The average affluent black lived in a neighborhood that was 11.6% poor. So it's, and I knew this would be true because it's true in almost every metro area in the country. It's just a universal characteristic of how segregation operates that I've used the phrase the truly advantaged, because Bill Wilson has written a book about the truly disadvantaged. And, well, what about the truly advantaged African Americans and Hispanics? Well, not so advantaged is the answer.
So some of that you touched with Aaron about the discrimination. So, you know, how much of this do you think is discrimination, or is sometimes that some of it is choice of living in metropolitan areas that say they feel comfortable in versus being discriminated against?
So there's definitely some preference involved here. And I've known for a long time. When I was 30 years ago as an assistant professor, I had some friends who worked for a fair housing group on Long Island that I was active in, and their daughter was getting married, had gotten married, they had a baby, they're black, and they were deciding where to live, and we talked about it, and they said, well, I think we'll go. And they named a predominantly black suburb on Long Island, Hempstead Village. They said, I think we'll live in Hempstead Village because we'll be more comfortable there. But, they said, of course, we're going to have to pay for private schools. Right? So and they were aware of their choices and making that choice. So I know that that's a reality. However, I think that when whites and Asians make choices based on their preferences and the choice results in their living in a better neighborhood, being able to use the public school because it's the best public school and so on, that it's more clear that that's a positive choice, whereas for African Americans it's a very constrained choice. It's very hard. There's only a few areas in the nation, in some suburbs of Atlanta, some suburbs of Washington, D.C., where if you're an affluent black family, you could choose to live in a predominantly black community and it would have low poverty and good schools. There's just a very few such places in America. And aside from that, that alternative is not available.
Okay, and I got one last item here before I turn it over to Representative Case and then Aaron. But you had some dealing with HUD, and I've talked to HUD officials, you know, on various levels, and it seems to me that they're great policy people, and that, you know, you could talk about their programs, but when it comes down to enforcing what the money is supposed to be spent for, it's like it's once it leaves Washington, it's like this money just is supposed to do what it's supposed to do. And it's been my experience, even talking to the HUD officials, that the enforcement part of this isn't, or you know, like a real priority. Have you talked to any HUD officials? Were you gotten any different sense from them?
I have some good friends who are former HUD people, and I think I get a more complete story talking to them. Actually, I think HUD operates on the whole with very good people and good intentioned people, but like every other federal agency, it's driven by serving a constituency, and you say, well, what is their constituency? So the constituency of the agricultural department is agribusiness. And whatever is good for agribusiness, the agriculture department has to, you know. And if they're in favor of food stamps, it's because it's good for agribusiness. You know, that you have to understand it that way. So what's the constituency for HUD? It's the construction industry, and particularly the segment of the construction industry that's looking for tax credits for affordable housing. And it's every municipality and county and housing authority in the nation that they dole money out to. That's the constituency. And they carry out their programs to serve their constituency. The constituency is not poor people who need housing. You know, you might think it would be, but the reality is, how could it be? Because poor people who need housing are not organized really very effectively as a national lobby, and they can't say, as this is what we demand, right? They depend on groups like the fair housing groups I've worked with to bring a lawsuit on their behalf. You know, it's the best they can do. So I think what HUD's way of dealing with the world is quite natural, and it's what we should expect in government. It's the normal thing. And what would not be normal is to have a secretary of HUD who says, actually, I'm not going to serve my constituency. I'm going to serve somebody else. And then what? At what risk? That the congressional committee that funds HUD will start cutting down the dollars because, bad boy, you're not serving who you're supposed to be serving, right? Okay, so
I asked for that, and boy, I tell you, okay. I didn't feel any better after hearing the answer. But
no, you should.
I'm not surprised.
This is not a feel good session, is it?
Representative Kasin, then Aaron.
Real quickly, looking at some of your slides and your information brought forward, and I thank you for doing that. Coming from a smaller community than some of us here that are representatives, it's interesting to see myself personally. I think I'm on the upper echelon because I'm white and I have three Asian sons. So, and in your information, you know, they're supposed to be the top of the line educated, and boy, if their grades show it, they would have been better in college. But to make a long
story
short,
just hope they'll do their homework, right?
Make a long story short, our high school is about 48% free and reduced lunch in a small community, and the high school just took the chance to make a change because of an impediment to where all students, we are a very diverse population in this community, whereas you'd be interested here, we just took in 26 Chinese students into the program at the school, and each year we will grow on that so that they can learn more about different ways of living and learning. But the one interesting thing is the superintendent of the schools and the principals just decided to say, listen, we're not going to segregate anybody and differentiate. So people who play sports are usually, you know, of different stature or come from a different area. So he says, fine, across the board, C minus or better, and no Fs, or you sit on the bench. And that's for everybody. Well, the grades went for the school system because these kids really learned. So, you know, it was a harsh decision. Parents were very difficult on it. But it was an impediment because there seemed to be a lot of favoritism because his quote in the newspaper was, we aren't here to make NBA students. We're here to teach kids.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, looking at the research that you've shown us, it proves, a lot of it proves true, and some communities are trying to make a difference with their poverty level.
I agree. And I hope you haven't thought that I've been saying that the only thing that matters is spending more money. I think
it's not the money.
The policies you carry out and the way you carry them out and how much attention you give to them and how much priority you give to them is the bigger part of the story. But it needs to go along with the money to support it. I believe in discipline and tough love. That's the way.
And I appreciate that. And I just, in all respect to the chairman here and co-chairman, you know, we talk a lot about the cities and the bigger populations, and the smaller communities have the same issues too. And it's harder to, because we don't have the populations of, the different nationalities being brought in large clumps. So it's hard to segregate those out. But the smaller communities, I represent four small communities, anywhere from 2,000 in one community to my largest community is 11,000. And you guys have much larger people. And
yeah, quite different. So what county is Waterbury in?
Waterbury's in New Haven. in county.
Oh,
but
so
I could say this.
County's not going to help.
We're going to go to Aaron, then Cheryl, but just to address what you talk about, represent case, I mean, you have similar issues but smaller numbers. So in the cities, there's thousands, and, you know, in the rural areas, there could be hundreds. But the multi-thousands in the metropolitan areas represent big dollars to drive. Now, if everybody in the rural areas decided that we wanted to address those issues too and came together with the city to address those particular areas, we could get something done. But the difference is the rural areas have more representation here than the cities. And when it comes down to actually spending some of these dollars to address some of these meaningful areas, that's when the ideology, the fights happen. Because it may cost $1.5 million to address it in a rural area. Right. It could cost $20 million in a city. So,
in
the state as a whole, when you look at it, it's like, oh, we're going to spend, 80% of our money is going to, help the cities, and, it will help the rural areas, but we're going to spend 85%. That's where we get caught up at. But if the rural areas realize that we're going to solve the problem not only in the cities but in our areas too, we could get buy-in. But that doesn't seem to happen, and we get caught up in that little dilemma.
I think that's what's happening in the first meetings tomorrow with the 20-town COG. For the Northwest Corner, is they're pulling 20 towns together, and they're meeting once a month to make decisions and trying to get a bigger pool of people instead of just one small community. So I guess it's one small step, and I think we're getting about four COGs throughout the state of Connecticut that are going to be working together and then pooling information. So that's an interesting thing that just came up. We used to have 9 towns, and now the governor has put it out to 20 towns. We actually got approval for 21 towns, so we go as far as Windsor Lock. So it's going to change with information.
I could. I could add just a little information here that is relevant to that conversation. I've also looked at non-metropolitan areas around the country. Some non-metropolitan areas are really pockets of affluence, and there's probably some areas, some towns in, non-metropolitan towns in Connecticut that are quite affluent. But on average across the country, non-metropolitan America has higher levels of poverty and unemployment than metropolitan America. And when we look at the school performance in non-metropolitan areas, it's not better than central city school performance. This is where we find very, very mixed in terms of race and ethnicity, a lot of poverty and unemployment, a lot of parents who are uneducated, and schools that don't perform very well. So many of the issues that I talked about in terms of white, black, metropolitan areas, when you're probably thinking city, suburb, and so on, They show up as a problem for non-metropolitan America on the whole, not just in Connecticut, but on the whole. Upstate New York. I used to teach in Albany. I'll tell you, upstate New York is a mess. You know, really terrible.
Okay. Aaron and then Cheryl.
All right, I'll try to be quick because I know we need to wrap up. And one thing in the future we might want to think about, there's a big difference, I think, in some of these areas between the levels of concentrated poverty, I think, and that's really at the heart of a lot of what we're talking about here. So, you know, that's something to consider. But I think there are things that are similar that could be worked on together across urban, suburban, and rural lines. I want to get to the back to the notion of preference really quickly and testing. We have, and for the analysis of impediments, we've analyzed 10 years of testing data and found that about half of the time Black families are going to be discriminated against when they're looking for housing. So, you know, absolutely that plays into it. In terms of preferences, those will also enter into things, but in our discussion groups with people on Section 8 around the state who were overwhelmingly African American women, we found that there's a deep desire to be able to move to higher opportunity areas. So if the housing is built, people will come and live in it, and I don't think we need to worry about that as we're thinking about where the housing should go. And we also need to think about things in communities like, you know, is driving while Black an issue there? Well, you're not going to really want to move somewhere if you're going to be arrested if you drive your car. So we need to think about how local community police departments are adjusting to a more diverse community, you know, population. And then lastly, just on the issue of where we spend our money, I mean, we need to be helping communities that are struggling, but we also need to be changing where the housing goes. And in the long run, we have to have our policies moving towards integration. I think that's the only way we can go when we're thinking of our planning for the future.
Okay, Cheryl?
I have a question for you, Professor. what I think is driving a lot of the disparity is the discrimination. I'm here as the designee for Senator Bartolomeo, but I'm a civil rights attorney at the CHRO, the state equivalent to HUD. And I think that the issue is really a commitment of resources to ending discrimination. Now, discrimination exists in housing, in education equality, and you know, with respect to the racial profiling that occurs. And it's breaking down all of that discrimination and the stereotypes that people have about exposure to other people that are different from them and getting buy-in, like from, you know, representatives, senators, the state as a whole, to fund and to support and to commit resources to ending that discrimination. Because currently, you talked somewhat about the law. Currently, I believe Connecticut is a very progressive state in terms of the legislation that we have to end discrimination, and that no state funds can be used in the furtherance of any discriminatory, you know, activities, meaning that even cities can't use funds that they get from the state to then engage in discrimination, like having zoning laws that are discriminatory or having laws that create a disparate impact on a particular group of protected class people like Blacks or Hispanics. And some of the things we've been talking about today appear that they would have this discriminatory impact on particular classes of people. But my question to you is, have you, through your research and in your discussions and exposure to this area, found a way to convince the powers that be that the commitment of resources is so important to the elimination of discrimination that it will actually have the effect of addressing a lot of the housing crisis and issues that we've been talking about, the educational disparities, the profiling issues, and the community decay. Do you have any suggestions for us?
Well, I think that the root problem here is that the average American public official is very much like the average American in terms of views about what is the actual current situation. The average American, the average public official thinks that we have taken care of discrimination, that it's passed, that was the 60s. It was the 40s, you know. But we're in a new era now. We've got a black president and whatever, right? And so my work is devoted to trying to document that's not really quite the case yet, and to get it as highly publicized in as much media and as many web pages and so on as I can. And, you know, I really work very hard at disseminating information in a form that is straightforward, objective, but clearly there's a message that goes along with it. And that's what I can do. I'm not a politician. I'm not even active in advocacy groups. There's things that need to be done by both those kinds of people, but I think that's the root problem. Not that people say, "Oh yes, this is a big problem, but we just don't have enough money." No, is it? No, that's a problem of the past. Nobody cares about that anymore. So we should use our money for things that are real current problems. That's the nut that has to be cracked. Yeah. And it's just so much more pleasant to believe that we solved that. You know, we solved something. And to some extent we have. Like, race relations in America are not like the 60s. Absolutely not like it. And we can't deny that. And it's just that... But it's not the paradise that people would like to believe it has become. Yeah.
Well,
thank you for listening to me for so long.
I have one final comment, and I can appreciate what you're doing, and I think it really boils down to raising the awareness, because, like, I believe, just like you believe, that the average people think discrimination is, that's something from the 40s, the 60s. That's gone. We've risen above that, but, you know, that it's not really actively, people don't actively engage in it today, which is, you know, more couldn't be further than the truth. It's just probably not as blatant or overt. But that brings the other part of this equation, the enforcement. I think somehow we got to raise the awareness, but then it's like, what do we do in terms of, where do you see, or when it comes to policy or methodology of enforcement, what would you think the areas would be most effective, or any other possible solution?
If there was any one thing that I could make it happen, it would be that every federal attorney and every county district attorney in America decides to devote some of their staff to discrimination in housing. That, you know, and so therefore not do something else. You'd have to take it away from something else. You're not going to get new money to do it. But even to have one person on everybody's staff whose job is to think about that problem and how would you address it and how would you collect information. And you've got 10 years of testing data. So what prosecutor is using those data? I want to know. Right? It's great to have the data, but so that would be the single thing. Not anything about HUD, not anything about money, just decide that it's worth a little bit of effort. Is that doable? Maybe in one county, five counties, statewide? Is it doable statewide?
Well, I don't know, but I like that. That was a great answer, and hopefully maybe we could make a pilot of it in some county and do it, and then look at the results, and then take those results and share it with the rest of the world and see if it really works well. We could roll it out to the rest of the world. So, but I'd like the answer. Any other questions or quick comments before we adjourn?
I'd just like to make the task force aware that Professor came up here from Rhode Island on his own nickel. Task force didn't have any money, but he was very gracious, and I, on behalf of the whole task force, I really want to thank you. It's been wonderful, and it added another aspect, and I think something will come of this. Yeah.
Good. Thank you. It's been a pleasure, actually. I've had a real good time. It's at least, it's more fun than teaching a class.
And we're meeting, the task force is meeting a week from today.
And I believe, Peter, did you say you're going to send a link that, the professor had?
Yes, all material will be up on the website very shortly, but if you want, we can send it out to all members as well.
Okay, thank you.